This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Arne Gundersen is an industry insider, a former executive in the U.S. nuclear power industry. He's a whistleblower on the safety of American nuke plants, from the oldies like Vermont Yankee to the new designs by Westinghouse. As Fukushima reactor buildings blew up in Japan, Arne Gundersen's insider sources and his experience added up to a series of devastating videos on his site at Fairwinds Associates. He's been on CNN, BBC, CBC, and likely that's just today. So, Arne, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad I could come.
I admire the way you patiently explain tricky nuclear information the rest of us do need to know. Why do you do it?
I was a teacher. I was a nuclear engineer and then a senior vice president. And when I blew the whistle, I was fired and then sued for $1.5 million. And in the process, I became a school teacher. And I sort of combined engineering skills and I learned how to teach. So it seems to be a natural way to go. So now that I'm back consulting full time, I find myself gravitating to teaching as well. And this gives me that opportunity.
Well, it really shows. I do have so many questions. Let's start out with Reactor 1. The utility TEPCO and the government admit part of the fuel rods have been exposed out of water, probably for weeks. David Lochbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists suggested they can't get water into that inner shroud. And on Monday, April 10th, the Japanese government said nitrogen that's being pumped in isn't staying inside the reactor, and so radioactive gas was leaking out. Talk to us about what is going on in Fukushima Daiichi Reactor 1.
Reactor 1, I guess the most recent thing is that when the nitrogen started leaking out, that wasn't a concern for me as far as I thought it would leak out of the reactor, but apparently it's leaking out of the containment. And you know, the industry's position has always been that these containments can't fail. And so not only do we have Unit 2 failed, and we'll get to that later, but here's Unit 1 unable to hold nitrogen gas inside. The core temperatures in Unit 1 are the highest. They're over 210 C, or close to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And of all the reactors on site, it is the hottest. So I would agree with Dave Lochbaum at UCS that that's an indication that there's a lot of blockage in that core, and it still has difficulty cooling.
Is there still a potential for a meltdown at Reactor 1?
Yes. Let me tell you why. The temperature at the feed water nozzles is 400 degrees F or 210 centigrade. But the relief valves are open. And what that means is that the vessel has air in it, because water can't exist at 400 degrees F and atmospheric pressure. So that tells me that the core is not being cooled. It's the smallest reactor. It only had 500 megawatts. The others were over 700. But the core damage plus the temperatures at the feed water nozzles lead me to be concerned. The last piece there is that they have been able to flood the outside of the vessel. And while they can't cool it from the inside, it's like they're putting water on the outside of the pressure cooker. And I think the only reason we don't have a meltdown in Unit 1 is that the heat is being removed through the pressure cooker, through the vessel itself, because it's certainly not moving around inside.
Now, even as the government announced a Level 7 event at Fukushima, they continue to say the worst radiation occurred in the first few days, up to March 15th, say, due to multiple hydrogen explosions and damage to Reactor Number 2. A month later, what can you tell us about Reactor 2?
Reactor 2 is in the worst shape. There's clearly a hole in the bottom of it. Now, there might still be nuclear fuel in the core, and I'm not suggesting that all of the nuclear fuel poured out the hole. But the reactor temperatures are such that there's no indication of water in the bottom of that reactor. On top of that, they had an explosion, but not the dramatic explosion. If you look at Unit 2, it looks like it's the best. But in fact, they had an explosion in the containment, which broke there's that torus down at the bottom and a toroidal structure. and there's a break there. So they're putting water in at the top of the vessel, it's running out the bottom of the vessel, and it's running out a crack in the containment. That seems to be what's causing the most contamination in those trenches and the ocean. But essentially, they're pouring ocean water, or now pure water, directly on top of fuel pellets, and that's carrying radiation out of the plant. Of all of the units, I think I could give you thoughts on how to fix everything at one and everything at three, but boy, I'll tell you, unit two is a really hard nut to crack.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson. I have a number of reports that Fukushima Reactor Number 3 has been so radioactive workers cannot even approach it to restore anything. Mary Olson from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service says photos show the spent fuel pool for Reactor Number 3 is gone. How serious is that situation at Reactor 3?
The reactor itself has temperatures, the best temperatures, very close to boiling, so it's probably the coolest of the three reactors. But I would agree with Mary that I have looked at the high-level photographs, and there's a little tiny hole where the fuel pool should be, and there are some vapors coming out of it, but it looks to me like half the fuel pool is gone. And there are also some infrared pictures out on the net, and they do show a heat source inside that little hole. What I think happened is Unit 3 had the most violent explosion, and the plume went up at least 2,000 feet, or almost close to a kilometer, but in any event, quite high. Yet the containment remained intact, and it was a direct upward shooting plume. And to me, that indicates that the fuel pool itself filled with hydrogen, and that behaved like a gun barrel. That aimed the blast upward. That would account for the fact that large pieces of nuclear fuel rods have been found as far away from the reactor as a mile and even 2 miles. So we're talking, three kilometers out, they're finding pieces of nuclear fuel rods. The most likely source of that is Unit 3. And then, so if you look at the pictures of those units side by side, it seems like it's about one floor shorter than Unit 4 due to the violence of that explosion. I'm not saying that all of the fuel is gone from that pool, because the infrared pictures do indicate a heat source. But I have my doubts about how much fuel remains in there and how much was thrown out. The bigger problem is, and I think this is the source term of radiation that concerns me the most, is volatilized heavy elements like plutonium. That explosion was so violent, and it clearly did involve the fuel pool, that I would suspect that some plutonium, I don't know how much, became a volatile gas, and of course that's very carcinogenic, so that's a concern of mine.
And wasn't that Reactor 3 burning the advanced MOX fuel that was laced with plutonium?
Yeah, it had 6% of its fuel was MOX, but all of the reactors, once a reactor starts to run, the U-238 converts over to plutonium. So all of them have plutonium. Unit 3 had a little bit more plutonium to start, but really, in the big scheme of things, they all are conceivable sources of plutonium.
All right. Well, Arnie, we know Reactor 4 wasn't operating at the time of the earthquake and tsunami. Most of the media reported fires there with the fire department responding, but Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Adano said Reactor 4, the fuel pond, exploded, just as you described for Reactor Number 3. We seem to have a YouTube video of it. I'm wondering if that Reactor 4 explosion ranks that up there with one of the most serious early events at Fukushima.
It is. The only thing it didn't release is iodine, because iodine has a short half-life, 8 days. And, of course, the fuel had been removed from the core about 4 or 5 months ago. So when the fuel pool cracked, and this is important, according to Areva, the French nuclear vendor, the fuel pool developed a crack in it during the earthquake. So the water ran out of the fuel pool before the tsunami, and it didn't boil dry, it ran dry. So from an engineering standpoint, that indicates a real concern about seismic calculations on a structure of this magnitude. But the pool was dry, and there clearly was what we call a Zirk water reaction. The Zirk alloy absorbs an oxygen molecule from water and then creates hydrogen, which blew up to Unit 4. And if you, I'm going to go over to my website now. If you go up on our website, there's a picture. They put a camera on the end of the device that was spraying water into Unit 4. And one of my jobs when I was in the industry is I ran a business that built nuclear fuel racks for Mark I Designs. And you can clearly see in about 4 seconds of the video clip that the fuel racks are in the pool, but the water is not in the pool. So the, whatever fuel is in the fuel racks, at least the top, is dry. So they can easily reach the ignition point of the Zirk water reaction, which is 2,200 degrees, and produce the hydrogen that we saw.
Ernie, I feel a little bit conned when officials just release figures for fast decay items like 131. And you mentioned uranium and possibly plutonium, and uranium-234 and 238 was detected in samples taken by the EPA in Hawaii, Southern California, and Seattle on April 6th. However, they say that those, well, quote, analysis of this batch of filter data identified low levels of uranium consistent with natural levels typically seen in the U.S., end quote. But other locations don't show up with uranium at all, just Hawaii and the West Coast, and they're not known as radioactive hotspots. Japan announced a few traces of plutonium only, and then later Kyoto on April 12th reported radioactive strontium detected more than 30 kilometers from the plant. Do you think that the most radioactive elements like strontium, uranium, and plutonium could be loose in the Japanese countryside with no warning from the government?
Yes. I think they can be loose on the North American continent, too. I'm counting on the independent scientists at universities to give us better numbers. I'm not convinced that either the Japanese government nor the American EPA is going to give us the best data. You know, I was an expert on Three Mile Island, and I saw this back in the 70s, where the government and the industry kind of circled the wagons and came up with a story that, when they controlled the data, it was very hard to refute. And the same thing happened on Chernobyl, of course, except it was so much more violent that it was pretty clear it was a world-class event. But again, the government and the industry begin to control the data. We live in a different era now, and I'm hoping that the independent labs on the and sharing information over the Internet can break through the logjam that the industry is trying to create and give us really some good science here.
And Arnie, if I understand what you've told us so far correctly, there's still a chance of more explosions or events which could spew more radioactivity reaching the Western Hemisphere, the Northern Hemisphere?
Yes. My concern with Unit 1 is that it's very heavy now. They've added all this water on the outside, and if there's an aftershock, sizable aftershock, you know, 7, 7.5, it could break Unit 1's containment. And that would then again begin the process because, again, Unit 1 is not being cooled from the inside, it's being cooled from the outside. And Unit 1 also had the hottest fuel, physically hottest fuel. Unit 2 continues to leak, and I think that problem is going to be the greatest source of liquid radioactive waste. I read today that there's 60,000 tons of liquid radioactive waste on site, and the Russians are coming with a special ship to process radioactive waste, and they can process 35 tons a day. Well, if you do the math, it'll be 5 years before this special ship processes all the waste if they don't generate any more. So they're going to run into problems with liquid waste and what to do with it on Unit 2. Unit 3, the reactor itself is probably the closest to being cool and under control. But as we said, the fuel pool is severely damaged and the contamination on the outside surfaces is extensive. So with the exception of probably being able to cool the reactor, it will be difficult to recover it. My biggest concern is a fire in Unit 4, a fuel pool fire in Unit 4, because I know the fuel is exposed. I've seen it on the videos. And if you volatilize plutonium in those quantities, you can expect, you know, serious health consequences in Japan, but also in North America. So that's my biggest concern right now.
And as you've mentioned, people bringing in equipment, they're also flying in two giant cement pouring trucks. Do you think that those could be used to bury the problem like Chernobyl?
I think they're going to try. They've actually modified those pumps to pump water, and they're going to try to push a lot of water into these reactors. My concern with that is that if they hit the pool in Unit 3 or the pool in Unit 4 with water and the fuel is hot, they may in fact create the Zirk water reaction and cause another explosion. The other thing is, I told you I built fuel racks before, and if they hit the rack with too much pressure, they can distort the elements so that they become closer together, and you can actually get a chain reaction again occurring because the geometry of the rack has changed and the elements become critical again. So too much water in Units 3 and 4 could actually cause an inadvertent criticality, and that would not be a good thing.
Do you think, Arne Gundersen, we should be closing old reactors in the United States?
Well, my position is on these. After Three Mile Island, the NRC went back and they said, look, for 90 days, we're going to shut down these B&W reactors, and we're going to look to see if there's any kind of a problem here that runs across the board. And this is the time of year to do it. And, of course, Three Mile Island occurred at the same time of year in March. Because, you know, in North America, there's a lull. There's a high peak in the winter and a high peak in the summer for electric use. But in the spring, there's not much electric use. So we could shut down our Mark I reactors for 90 days and look hard at the Fukushima data and see if there's any substantial problems. And if there are, of course, you'd want to shut them down. And if there's not, you wouldn't miss it, because there's more than enough power on the grid. My position on a few reactors is more stringent than that. I think we've got a couple of these Mark I reactors do have a Fukushima-like flaw, a single point of vulnerability. It's not to a tsunami or an earthquake, but they do have an engineered feature that everybody knows about, that if one component fails, you will get a Fukushima event. You'll be unable to cool the core. The NRC is aware of that and hasn't asked for those half dozen reactors to shut down. And that's a concern of mine.
Could you mention just the names of a couple of those?
The problem is called the net positive suction head, and it's also called a containment overpressure credit. And Vermont Yankee, Robinson, Dresden and Quad Cities all use that overpressure credit, which basically means that they need the containment pressure to push water to the emergency pumps. And if there's a flaw in the containment, not a major crack, but a flaw, and the containment can't push water to the pumps will fail. And the NRC knowingly violated its own regulations in allowing these plants to be increased in power. Before they had their power uprates, they didn't need this containment overpressure. But in order to make more money and more power, the NRC just waived its own regulations and allowed them to assume that the containment wouldn't fail. And I don't think that's a good assumption. Before Fukushima, it wasn't a good assumption. And now after Fukushima, it's obviously not.
As we wrap up, is there something that I've missed that you would like our listeners to know?
What I am asking the NRC to do is, you know, don't shut down the industry or anything like that, but this is a time to pause and reflect about, we don't need to go headlong into continuing to license plants right now. We can take a pause and not renew licenses for 20 years when we don't know what happened with Fukushima, and not give power increases until we know what happened to Fukushima, and also with the new ones. We've got this AP1000 design And it has a glaring single point of failure in this in its design. And I think the NRC has assumed these problems will not occur. And I've literally argued with the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards and said they have told me there is zero probability of a containment leak. Well, Fukushima 1, 2, and 3 clearly have leaked, and the NRC's argument, I think, was wrong even before that. But in light of Fukushima, I think we need to go back and look across the board for these single points of vulnerability.
You've heard it. Some real safety tips. Find our guest, Arnie Gunderson, at fairwinds.com. Just add an E to the end of fair to find that. Or Google Arnie Gunderson and look for his powerful videos on YouTube. You'll be a lot smarter when it comes to the real risk of nuclear plants near you. Arnie, on behalf of everyone looking for straight answers, I want to thank you.
Thank you. I had fun.
I'm Alex Smith. Find us at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.